Welcome to another PI World podcast. This is an audio-only version offered as another way to enjoy our great content. A full video version can be seen on piworld.co.uk, where you can find many more videos of interest to investors.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you for attending our full year presentation. The first point I'd like to just summarise with about the year is, obviously, after a difficult start, we were delighted that we could continue with our scaling of the business. But in growing the business as we do, and you've seen hopefully the results and the extent to which we scale the business and have grown it even in this challenging year, I'm delighted that we've maintained our discipline of cash collection and our focus on profit and cash has been with us now for coming up a decade. And we've been able to maintain those disciplines and that those results, even as we've continued to grow the business significantly. As we've gone through this challenging year, we had a very tough Q1 that we've reported on previously, and then we've seen a strong recovery. I think what's been revealed through this difficult year that we've had is just the resilience of our business, but also all the work that we did before this year, sort of going back 2 years ago, to really get ready to build the platform for this growth. And we've done that in two main ways. We've built a client services executive. These are 8 directors currently, and we'll continue to grow this team of directors, client service directors. And they report to me, and we work closely together every week. And they run the offices, and I'll talk about those more shortly. We've also scaled up the operations team. We've talked about this many times before. And I think the resilience has also come from the platform that we created 2 years ago. Here, we're just sort of revealing the growth that we've achieved. We've obviously grown the top line very healthily, but we've been able to grow the bottom line even better, as you hope to see in the sort of opportunities that we have to consolidate the segment of outside London legal and professional services. And again, just to repeat, we've grown the business profitably, but we've also been able to maintain that strong discipline of cash collection. We're clearly the fastest growing legal service business, as reported by the lawyer. But also, as well as focusing on the delivery of profit and cash, what we've seen in this year, which has been obviously a very fascinating and challenging period, but we've also seen the mood in the camp get better. I think the communication between our people, between our partners, our leaders, our client service directors, our operations directors, I think the business has really come together and communicated exceptionally well using the new tools that we've discovered of Zoom and Teams. And I think that's been shown in the Net Promoter Score. We ask our people regularly, and that's gone up from the plus 36 to plus 39. And there is a strong mood in the camp, I think, now with some pent-up energy ready to go as we hopefully go back into offices, which I'll talk a little bit about later. We've also seen a great reaction from the Net Promoter Score clients. That's gone up from plus 60 to plus 75. We asked the top 250 clients by revenue, and I think we've got very, very happy clients from a really sort of strong mood in the camp, which I think has been revealed through this period. Kate, can I hand over to you there?
Thank you. So as David has said, for the last 9 years now, we've driven the business basically for profitable cash generative growth. And so delighted with the results that we're presenting this year, especially given the fact that we've been in a pandemic and we were hit quite hard in the first half of the year. So delighted that we've broken the 100 million turnover barrier. We've grown the turnover by 39%. Despite the impact that the pandemic had during the first half of the year, and that we've also grown the underlying profit before tax to 18.4 million. So that's a growth of 35%. Cash conversion, as you can see there, has remained strong, which is excellent given the macroeconomic environment that we've been in, and continues to be as a result of the strong lockup management that we have always done during in nights. And that's resulted in our net being slightly better than we'd expected, so at 21.1 million. And I'll explain the detail behind some of these figures over on the next few pages. So here we've summarised the income statement for the year. We've talked first about revenue. So our revenue growth of 39%, has mainly come from acquisitions. So we've generated 2.1 million of income from acquisitions that were completed during this financial year. And that income has effectively come from the acquisitions of OTB Evelyn, which we completed in November, and then Mondays, which we exchanged for in March. There's also the impact of the acquisitions that we completed during FY20. You may recall that we did 6 acquisitions during the year. Those acquisitions, we budgeted a total of approximately £37 million worth of revenue. We recognised just over £10.5 million worth of revenue last year. So the increase in revenue this year at 28.4 is actually slightly ahead of what we'd have budgeted it to be, which is demonstration of how well those acquisitions have integrated into the business, especially pleasing given the lockdown situations that we've been in. And I think we've been in lockdown since we acquired the last 3 of those. So I'm really pleased with those acquisitions and their performance. The organic growth, it's really a year of two halves when we talk about organic growth. The first half of the year, as you'll recall, was hit quite hard by the pandemic during the first few months as people stopped transacting and the world sort of stopped turning for a few months. And we experienced 15% reduction in organic income during the first half of the year. But the second half of the year, that has returned, and we're reporting double-digit organic growth for the second half of the year if we compare to H2 of 2020. I'm really pleased with that as we're coming out of the pandemic, momentum is increasing and we're back to the levels of growth that we would normally expect to be at. If we look at gross margin achieved on that, that's again a story of two halves really. During the first half of the year, because we could see the hit on income that we were having, we took very early decisions to make some cost savings during that first half of the year. You'll recall that staff that earned over 30,000 took a 10% cut in salary for that period. And that did help us to maintain gross margin during the first half of the year. That was maintained at 46%, which was comparable to what it had been the prior year. Moving into the second half of the year, as we could see that trading was improving and returning towards normal levels, we instated salaries as of the 1st of November. And really pleased that given the organic growth that we've had during that second half year, we've actually managed to increase our gross margin slightly to just under 49% for the year compared to 48% last year. Operational staff, just quickly touch on that point. The operational staff cost has increased as a percentage of income compared to the prior year. It's now at 9.7% of income compared to 9.3% in last year's accounts. The reason for that is our continued investment in the support staff and the management of the firm. If you may recall that during the latter half of FY20, we invested in support staff and management to manage the growing business that we'd acquired with the 6 acquisitions that we'd done during FY20. And so we've got the full year benefit of that cost in this year. And also we've continued to invest, as David talked about previously, we've invested in 2 new client service directors for the business so that we've got a sustainable support function to support the growth that we can see coming now throughout the business. But at 9.7%, we're still happy with that percentage. And I do see that as we continue to see organic growth and we continue to grow the top line, I hope to see that figure starting to leverage it in the future. It's just worth noting very briefly that we did all that without actually taking any benefit from the government furlough scheme. We did feel that as a profitable cash generative business, it just wasn't right to claim furlough and benefit from that. So we didn't benefit from any furlough. If we move very briefly now onto the PBT margin, again, a year of two halves. The first was hit by the impact of COVID, and although we'd made cost savings, so obviously a base cost that needs to continue. And so we did have a reduced PBT margin during the first half at 13% compared to 16.4%. But then the second half of the year, delighted that as we've grown the turnover and we've returned to pre-pandemic levels, that we've increased our margin in the second half of the year to 21.8%, which compares to 19.8% in the prior year and 17.4% in H2 of FY19, showing that as we're growing, we're continuing to start to leverage those overheads. I've included here, just really for transparency, just to explain how we calculate organic growth. I know everybody's always interested in organic growth. And because as we integrate businesses, as we acquire business, we approximate that it takes roughly 12 months for them to be fully integrated into the Knights business, so that they come onto our system straight away. So what we do for transparency and for ease of calculation, we always exclude the income from an acquisition in the year of acquisition and then in the following year when we're looking at our organic growth. And so there, very briefly, you can just see that our organic growth for FY21 is calculated taking out, obviously, the acquisition income for acquisitions made in this financial year, but also taking out the acquisition income from acquisitions made in FY20 and comparing it to the, so that shows a 3.2 million increase in organic revenue, and we're comparing that to the acquisition income in the second half of H220, excluding the acquisition income there, so the 31.7 million there, and that's generating our 10% organic revenue growth in the second half of the year. Very briefly, just picking up mainly on the points that I've talked about already in relation to the profit bridge, so I won't talk through each item, but you can see there that we've moved from a reported underlying PBT of 13.6 million last year to 18.4 million this year. A couple of points to pick out there is obviously the big item is the contribution from the FY20 acquisitions. That says estimated there because, as you'll be aware, we do fully integrate businesses onto our systems. And so we can't pull out an accurate PBT of the acquisitions that we have done, but we can look at how they're performing and the cost savings that we've made and then estimate where we think it is. And those are performing as we'd expected and have added £5.6 million worth of PBT during the year. That's offset slightly. You'll see the COVID organic decline in H1. We reported a £4.8 million decrease in turnover, which we'd offset by the £3.1 million cost savings we'd made, but that did impact us negatively by about £1.7 million. The other point, just to pick up very quickly on there, is the additional lease cost from IFRS 16. That's obviously under IFRS 16. If we sign new rental leases for property, they have to be recognised on the balance sheet and amortised over the balance sheet to the P&L over the period of the lease. During the pandemic situation, we've had really good opportunity to take advantage of some really good lease incentives that were available. We always see offices as being a real key important part to the Knights business, a place where we want people to work together collaboratively as part of a team, and we see them as being a big part of the office culture going forward. Therefore, it was a really good opportunity while people were working at home to take the time to invest in some really good lease incentive opportunities. So we signed new leases in Birmingham, Leeds and Nottingham, the new acquisitions that we'd acquired last year. And there's a bit of an additional lease cost there during that year, but that will start to leverage as we start to recruit into those offices and leverage that cost further. Here I've reported key performance indicators. As I've talked about previously, the key strategy for management and for the business is that we want to grow profitably with good cash conversion. And so as a board and a management team, the key indicators that we look at on a regular basis are those three indicators that you can see there: the underlying profit margin, the revenue growth, and the cash conversion. We've moved away slightly from a fees per fee earner that we've reported in the past, because I think as a diversified business that's got different levels of fee earners generating different levels of income, it can get a little bit distracted. And actually, we're interested in profitable growth regardless of the actual individual fees per fee earner. So this is the way that we manage the business, and these are the KPIs that we've reported here. So you can see there the movement on gross profit margin and PBT margin over the period. If we take discount the slight dip in PBT margin this year, which has been impacted by the COVID pandemic at the first half of the year, you can see that that's growing on a nice trajectory going forward. And so the revenue growth that we're putting through, which at a compound annual growth rate is 44%, is generating increasing profits, hence generating the increased profit of compound annual growth of 57% that Dave has talked about. Cash conversion at 91%. Is excellent cash conversion. It's something that we always strive to do. The way that we manage our cash conversion, the way that we keep it very strong, is demonstrated on the next page by our lockup days. We always look and target lockup days of being around about 90 days. Now, for anyone that's not listened to in that presentation before, our lockup days were defined as effectively being the amount of time it takes from to convert a unit of time spent on a client to the time that we actually get cash in the bank. And we target that at around 90 days, being approximately 60 days to build the work and then 30 days to collect the cash in. And that is industry leading average. The average for the industry is approximately about 130 days. So if we're targeting around about 90 days, that's really significantly better than the rest of the industry. And you can see there that generally we are always achieving around about that level. It will change very slightly year on year, but we're really pleased with where we achieve and how we achieve that. We've not had to change any of our lockup management during the COVID pandemic, because we've always been on top of debtors. We've not had any old debtors. We've not had an issue with bad debts during the period. Our bad debt charge for the year has remained at 0.2% of revenue, which is what it's been historically for the last 2 or 3 years. So we haven't had any negative impacts on our lockup or bad debts because of COVID. I talked very briefly about the impact of acquisitions on lockup. The 85 days and the 89 days that we've bought in FY20 and FY21 do exclude the acquisitions, the impact of the lockup on acquisitions that we completed just in the last quarter of the year. And the reason we excluded them is because when we acquire a business, they generally have a much higher lockup profile, and then we work with them over the next 6, 12, 18 months to bring that down towards our levels. And if we look at what we've done with the acquisitions that we completed in FY20, when we acquired them, they had an average lockup of around about 130 days. And over the last year, we've worked with them to bring that lockup down to around 97 days. So still a little bit further to go, but a really pleasing result over the last 12 months. Just very briefly look at the balance sheet, and there's not an awful lot to pick up on there. One item just to pick out will be the right of use assets. As I've talked about previously, under IFRS 16, when we sign up and agree to a new lease, we have to recognise that on the balance sheet as a right of use asset, and we have to recognise the related liability as a liability on the balance sheet as well, because of the opportunities available, and because we see offices as being such a key part of our strategy, we have invested during the year, and hence you can see the increase there from last year. Just for clarification, the FY21 figures for the balance sheet do include the results of the Keebles acquisition that we exchanged at the 8th on the 30th of April. So those are consolidated into the balance sheet figures, although obviously there's no impact on the P&L for the year. The other figure, just to pick up there, is the net debt figure of 21.1 million, which we're really pleased about it finishing at that level, which was slightly ahead of where we'd expected. If we go on to the next slide, we've got a bridge of the movements, key movements in the net debt over the year. So we've moved from 15.9 million last year to 21.1 million this year, but that is after paying approximately 12 million out for cash on acquisitions. You can see there that actually the operating cash flows that we generate are very strong, the reason for the increase is purely due to the acquisitions that we've done, paying for amount paid acquisitions last year and acquisitions completed during the year. Just to pick up on there, there is an amount at the end of FY20, we had taken advantage of the VAT deferral scheme. We'd deferred our VAT, about 800,000 of that had been deferred. That has all been paid during this period, and there are no further amounts outstanding. So that was a one-off hit during this year. But pleased with where we are at the moment. You can see we're about 0.8 times of FY21 EBITDA, and we've got circa £19 million worth of headroom in our current facilities, where we've got a £40 million facility, which is committed until June 23. Just looking at our net debt and how we manage that and how we look at capital allocation, how we feel about leverage, the key building blocks to the board's consideration of capital allocation is set out here. We've got at the moment circa 19 million headroom. We're highly cash generative throughout the business, and we would always target at being circa 80% cash generative, which has obviously given us more funds available that we can then invest and allocate over the main strategy for the business. The three elements that we would invest it in are organic growth. We want to continue to invest in organic growth. And one of the key ways that we grow organically is by recruiting individuals who bring with them client following. When we recruit an individual, it does require investment, because if you were to recruit a partner, for example, it will take an average of probably 3 to 6, maybe sometimes 9 months before they're up to their full fee earning run rate level. And so for those first few months, you are actually investing in the recruitment of those individuals. So we do need some capital allocated to support that organic growth that is important to us. There's then also the acquisitive growth. We often talk about if we will do selective acquisitions as and when the ones with the right culture come along. In terms of funding those, we generally pay for them. A third cash up front, a third paper, and then a third will be deferred over a couple of years. In terms of where we feel we can get to it on leverage in order to do acquisitions, at the moment you've seen we're 0.8 times EBITDA. We do feel that given the cash generative nature of the business, we could take that up to 1.5-2 times EBITDA for the right acquisition, because we were generally generating cash so quickly that we would bring that back down to lower levels. And then our progressive dividend policy. We haven't paid a dividend for this year because we didn't feel it right because of the other savings that we've taken into the business. But we have stated that we do intend to restate the dividend at the normal level of 20% of profit after tax going into next year. So if we take all of that together and we take into account what is already committed in relation to acquisitions that have already been completed in prior years and in this year, and then an organic growth in the dividend, it gives us cash available with our current facilities to potentially acquire businesses of around about £40 million worth of revenue. Over to you, David.
Thank you, Kate. So this slide, I'm just wanting to illustrate the sort of spiraling effect that we feel. Now we've sort of gone over 100 million. I think the presence and awareness and reputation of Knights is more significantly known in the market. That's attracting new recruits from other top 50 law firms. We're probably now just broken into the sort of top 40. So other top 50 partners recognize us as a peer that they can join and safely onboard their client followings. That brings on significant clients and good quality clients. That then attracts more people. That then brings more awareness to the market on acquisitions. We now get some firms ringing us up. I had a firm only on Monday call me to see if we'd be interested in looking at them, and we are. So we get some calls now. We still go into the market to look at our pipeline that we know and are very familiar with, but we get calls. And this all then adds to the momentum, and it spirals around attracting more people and attracting clients. So I just wanted to illustrate that sort of spiraling effect there. I mentioned the client service directive that have been a key building block for us from 2 years ago. And thank goodness we did this sort of before COVID to see us through this COVID year that I've talked about. Their roles, there's three things that they do. I refer them to them as culture carriers. We're passionate about our culture. I'm going to talk about that in a second. These are the people that carry and lead that culture with all the partners too. But they're there as regional directors, if you like, regional managing directors, if you wanted to call them that. They all have responsibilities for 2 or 3 offices. So culture carrying, the financial management, the cash collection, the discipline that we want to bring to legal services is their responsibility. The third thing they do is integrate acquisitions. So all the people, apart from Paul there, who's now an additional client service director for another acquisition that we're getting Paul ready. He's been working for the last 6 months with shadowing James Sheridan, one of the client service directors, so that we've been getting him ready for how he leads an acquisition integration for us. So they integrate acquisitions. I think some of the key things to integrating acquisitions are to have somebody responsible for the leadership of that, and that's the client service director. It's to immerse them in it and start to bring new people into that business and show them how we want that group to integrate culturally, show them the behaviours that we're looking for. So those are the client service directors, and that's how we currently are on top of looking after 16 offices as we've scaled the business. The culture that I've mentioned, I do believe is unique in the sector, in the legal sector, and perhaps even a wider field in professional services. And I think it's unique in three ways. The way in which we've come together as one business. I think in legal services, you see silo, you see internal competition, my client, my fees, my profit share. It's quite individualism and silo. Here we at Knights, we're very different to that. It's one of the reasons 9 years ago we got rid of personal targets. It served us brilliantly to create a business community, one business community, where people share clients, share jobs, share resource across all 16 offices. The second thing we talked a lot about is this strong financial management, leading working capital days, those 90 days, very unique. And we've done that because we've focused on it for a decade. And the third way is the way in which we embrace technology. So just talking briefly about those, the business community, this one team approach. And I think this comes from the top. It comes from me. It comes from those client service directors. We show how we can share work. Whenever we do a partner hire, we don't always achieve it, but we try and find the best job that's going in the business and pass it to that partner. And so there you go. You're a new corporate partner. There's a corporate transaction. And it wows them. They've never experienced that before. If a real estate partner comes, we try and do the same with a real estate transaction. We try and involve new people in the big clients. We've done that recently with a commercial partner who started in January. He's now leading our McDonald's account. He's now a key player. We've passed that account to him. And this wows people. This is how we lead a one business approach. Get no personal targets, no individualism, getting everybody to trust being together. It's pretty unique, but it's very powerful. It's very strong when a team performs together. Dare I mention a certain football team that did that really well until the final, but they did a brilliant job of being a team. I think the egos were suppressed in the way in which Southgate led them. And that's what we do at Knights. We keep the egos suppressed and the team flourishes and everybody starts to trust that they can share their clients, share their work, use different experience levels so that we have younger, inexperienced people processing cost effectively and the experienced people leading and bringing their expertise when it's necessary, giving us a stronger value for money offering to clients. That's what it's all about. It's working because the Net Promoter Score confirms that to us. Clients like feeling a team approach where people aren't fighting over the clients and competing for them, where all of our resource is there now, which is significant. We've got full capability as a legal service business now. There's nothing we couldn't do for a corporate client now these days. And the clients like knowing that everybody's together servicing them, and it produces very happy clients and gives great cross-selling opportunities. So happy clients, one business community and team approach gives this opportunity now that is kind of untapped for us. We believe now by focusing on a much larger client group, so looking at the data of all of our clients, working with the client service directors and the partners, starting to do more client reviews with clients to see what they think and what they need, and listening to them and seeing what services that we could support them with. And we see a strong organic growth opportunity for us with cross-selling, but our culture is in a good place to, I think, build from that. But it's a new habit for lawyers and for professionals. It's not an easy thing to suddenly think about cross-selling when you're immersed into a transaction or a certain job for a client. So this is something that I think will take some time, but we're going to work hard at now organically growing the business by doing more for our clients. The financial management, we've talked a lot about this, but it comes from those client service directors taking responsibility for delivering those WIP and debtor days in their offices. And it's in the business. If you pull any of our 250 partners or any of the other fee earners to one side and ask them about this, they know about it. This is something that is talked a lot about in the first 3 months of induction with either new recruits or when we do acquisitions. And clients like it too. It's very sort of counterintuitive. This clients like being kept up to date with their billing. They like monthly billing. It takes the surprises away. They like being spoken to about fees and pricing. We've just increased all of our rates from 1 May, and we've got the whole business engaged, talking to their clients about those new rates. It's a great engagement opportunity. Again, a lot of professionals are shy talking about money, but we encourage this a lot in our business, and it brings this financial discipline to the fore. The embracing of technology is the sort of third limb of, I think, our unique culture. We've got everybody on one platform. Everybody's on the same IT system and practice management system. It's done day one on an acquisition. The moment we complete, they're on our system. And this is very important culturally. I think embracing technology is much more a cultural and behavioral thing than it is an actual type of system or software. And the first thing we did a decade ago was take secretaries out of the business model. It wasn't popular when we did it all that time ago in 2011. But it served as well to remove the crutch of the secretary and get the partner to actually switch the computer on and start to use the laptop. You can't survive at Knights for the first hour if you don't embrace your laptop and work electronically. So the first step to that was a long time ago, taking the secretaries out of the model, and we've stuck to that all the way through. We've never had secretaries, which means our professionals use the technology. They use their laptop and they work electronically. We got rid of paper files all that time ago, and we got everybody to work electronically. If they need to request something like a transfer of funds or some disbursement to be paid, they do it electronically. If they want to book a meeting room, they do it electronically. They don't ask, they don't have a PA or secretary. I don't have a PA, nobody has a PA. We work electronically, and it makes us quicker, makes us faster. There's speed in all of this and embracing technology. And I think that decade of culture of using technology yourself rather than people running around for you has meant that we're now in a strong place to think about, well, what next? How can we automate our business more? How can we embrace technology advances that exist, that we're not pioneering, that have been out there for a while? Word recognition software, these sorts of things. How can we use our client data and technology to look at what it is we've got much more than, as I've mentioned, to cross-sell to clients more? So this is all, I think, an opportunity that comes from a good place culturally. Kate touched on the acquisitions that we did now over a year ago. In sort of Feb, March, April, we did these acquisitions. The last three, as Kate's mentioned, we had to actually integrate whilst in lockdown, which was, you know, a surprise to us. And how's that going to go? And we've mentioned this when we've previously reported at half year, that it's gone better than it actually went pre-COVID. And I think there's some reasons for this, that people in their homes, they're very attentive. They're very in need of sort of knowing how the technology works, because that's how it's going to support them in their homes. So I think they've received it faster. I think the integration on the technology side and them using our systems has gone quicker. I think we've been able to actually communicate with them more through Zoom and Teams than we would have done in person. So we've learned that as well. There's been on the acquisitions, going back to these, there was a lot of work done last sort of May, June, July. Whilst there was carnage occurring around us, we knew that we had to work hard with the people that we'd acquired, and we did that. And I think the results are great that Kate's mentioned. The lockups come down to the 97 days. And the revenue churn, I just want to briefly touch on churn, because this gets asked understandably quite a bit. And I think there's a slight misconception that any churn is negative, and it simply isn't. I think there's a healthy amount of churn. When you take a very old-fashioned profession that law is, and you take an old-fashioned independent law firm, and they all are old-fashioned, they work with secretaries, they don't use technology, they're in scruffy offices, it's quite silo, and we almost sort of bring this modern world to them, then there's going to be some churn. There's some healthy churn, and we say healthy churn is sort of up to 20%. And we see that churn. But I think what's useful for you to see is the revenues that we've now been able to illustrate on these recent acquisitions going back almost 18 months ago. And you can see it there, that we plan, if we go to that 20% healthy churn, we've done 2 million more than that sort of that planning. We did the 39 million almost from those acquisitions. And that's notwithstanding that you do see the reduction of people that we've shown there in that 70 fee earners. That's healthy churn, and that's what we plan. That's the right way. If you didn't have any churn, we would be left with deadwood partners still there that weren't fee earning, that weren't doing anything, that were having meetings for meeting's sake. That's not our business. That's not how we operate. So just to try and hopefully clarify churn for you, we could go right back to some of the early acquisitions, going back to even 10 years ago and 5 years ago, and we've got very similar results. But I think we've really cracked a nut with acquisitions on how to integrate them safely. I think it does start with choosing the right ones. I think the cultural fit is where this healthy churn rate comes from, that you should pick the right ones culturally, and then you'll get to a good result, because people want to be part of our bigger group, the Knights Group. Just on recent acquisitions, I mentioned in January that I thought we might be delayed on dealing with our pipeline, but we've gone back to the pipeline and started to talk. I'm delighted that we've probably done the sort of two recent ones in March and May there, listed Mondays and Keebles, faster than I anticipated. We knew them and we'd been talking to them before, but as we sort of revisited them and started to have a meeting with them, things started to get going a bit quicker than I perhaps thought they would do in lockdown conditions. So really pleased that we've gone into Weybridge. This around the M25 strategy is a really good one for us. And I think we've got more wind in our sails on that, I think, as some partners are now debating the commute into London more. So I think we'll be able to organically grow from the Crawley, Maidstone, Weybridge. We're interested now in north of London around that sort of St. Albans, Luton area. We think there's opportunities for us there too, maybe organically or acquisitively. So we like the M25 strategy, and Mondays was part of that. Keebles was a tremendous acquisition for us. It happened very quickly for the simple reason of cultural fit. It's probably, we've done 14 now since IPO in the last 3 years, and I think this is right up there as having the strongest cultural fit of those 14. So it happened very quickly. It was easy. The group of 10 equity partners wanted to be part of Knights. They were coming in eagerly and positively. So all the other VNs have followed that, and it's integrating magnificently for that reason. And it really sort of completes the Yorkshire focus. We're in York, we're in Leeds, we're in Nottingham, and this Sheffield presence really sort of fills a gap between Leeds and Nottingham really well for us. So good, a great sort of finish the year, but start this campaign as we come out of lockdown, hopefully now, with acquisitions. And you know, there will be more acquisitions to come, and I was pleased that we could get those two done so easily. So to finish, really, I think this has been another landmark year. Clearly, we've achieved greater scale, and I've mentioned while maintaining our strong focus on profit and cash, but also culturally delighted with where the business is at and how cohesive we feel through this weird year that we've gone through, all 15 months. I think the momentum that we've shown in the second half will continue now. I think I see no reason why we won't go forward from here. Really excited about coming back into offices. I mentioned that I'd say where we're at with that very quickly. And we just announced last night, we talked to all of our people as we do these announcements, and we did a webinar to all 1,200 yesterday and confirmed that we do now want to open our offices. We're going to do it slightly cautiously. I think 1 August, we're going to open them, and then we're going to hope to plan to be in them properly from 1 October. We've confirmed that we now want a flexible approach to working where we'll use the offices at least 60% or more, so allowing people up to 40% of flexible time. I think it'll end up being circa 25%. I think people want to be in the offices, they want to be together, but I think we will get more out of our offices. I think we'll get 20-25% more utilization out of the offices through flexible working. So that's coming up. I think that will unleash a lot of energy in our business and hopefully a lot of businesses. And I think the UK will be energized now as we hopefully come to learn to live with COVID, as we've clearly got to. So I think the momentum's with us. The pipeline of acquisitions is there. I think we will attract more recruitment. And I think this whole period has been a great one for us to see that strength, resilience, and all of our people working so effectively. So we remain very positive and more excited than ever to come back into the normal office life and start to pursue our vision to create a leading legal and professional service business outside of London. So thank you very much. I think we can now move over to questions.
And we'll go to Robert Plant from Panmure Gordon.
Thanks. Morning, David. Morning, Kate. Two questions, please. I wondered, Kate, whether you're being a bit harsh on yourselves in terms of lock-up days, because although both the 89 and the 85 are comparable in that they're excluding a quarter of acquisitions, actually the acquisition drag in full year 20 was big. I know it's already gone down, but it's gone down to 97 days. So that 89 days might be a bit harsh. It might be better if you could exclude some of those acquisitions. So I wondered if you had a figure for that and whether my logic was correct. And secondly, a note in the statement, you talk about the last 2 months of trading being strong. Did they strengthen above the 10% of the second half? In a way, I suppose they should have done, because the comparable would have got easier because lockdown started in mid-March last time.
In terms of the lockdown, Rob, thanks for that question. It's always been our policy that we just exclude them for the acquisitions for the first quarter, and then they come in and we report them, and it may be a reason why lockup is slightly higher. But yes, you are correct. It will have had a slightly negative impact on the overall lockup for the business, because as you've seen, we've reported that those six acquisitions still had lockup of 97 days, which is better than the rest of the business. Excluding that, I haven't got an accurate figure, but I would estimate it's probably taken a couple of days off there. So we're probably down at about 87 days if we excluded, but because they're now integrated and part of the business, we report them in as part of nights going forward. But yes, it is having, it is probably part of the explanation for the increase from 85 to 89, but we're still really pleased with 89. It's still where we want to be. We still target 90 days. I think it's still much better than you know, the industry average at circa 130, so still pleased with where we are. In terms of trading, yes, we've seen gradually sort of momentum build throughout the year. March and April are historically for us always the stronger months of the year anyway. We reported when we did the half year that we did have a, when we did the trading update, that we did have a bit of a blip during late January, early February. We just felt that things slowed just a little bit, that we'd seen good recovery in November, December and early January, then it just slowed a little bit during end of January, early Feb, I think, as sort of lockdown fatigue stuck in, and I think everybody suffered the longest January that we'd ever experienced, which I think just impacted slightly then. But yes, then March and April, we've seen things returning to good levels and where we'd want them to be.
Thanks, Kate.
And we'll go to James Allen from Liberum.
Two questions from me, please. So first one, you've mentioned in the results the acquisition of Housing Law Services, which I don't think came out as an RNS at the time, but please could you give us a bit more information on that one, i.e. was that a team hire? And secondly, you've mentioned that as Knights has got bigger and now you're a top 40 law firm, you're seeing more and more recruits and applicants from other top 50 law firms. Have you seen more referrals in terms of clients as well from your existing client base as you've grown? So for example, one of your clients is McDonald's. Have you seen big corporates like that referring work to you because of the good work you've done?
Okay, let me pick up on both those, Kate. Well, you do the Housing Law Services, Kate. You'll know more about that than me.
Okay, so Housing Law Services, we didn't disclose that. It was small, we didn't need to. Turnover circa £500,000. So it wasn't significant enough to disclose. It was an acquisition. We perhaps reported it as an acquisition accounting wise. We acquired the trading assets of the business, so for accounting reasons we've had to treat it as an acquisition, but it is effectively a team of around about six housing specialists that will come and they will fit into our Maidstone Crawley offices and help develop the other housing specialisms that we've got and we acquired when we did the Croftons acquisition a couple of years ago. So it builds on that team very nicely, but that's the reason you've not heard from it. It's a small, effectively team hire, but done via an acquisition.
The second point there, James, I think to a certain degree, yes, we are seeing more activity from corporate clients. I think it's early days in that we have a job to do to let people know our capability, because people's view of your capability is always kind of behind the curve when you're growing quickly as we are. For example, now we've just taken the head of tax for another top 40 law firm and teams. So we've got we've built the tax team very recently, and now our job is to make sure our people to start with understand our tax capability, which has gone up a notch, and this is law and accountancy actually working together. And then we need to sort of make sure that our people are talking with their clients more about the capability. So if I pick the McDonald's one you've mentioned, we were only doing real estate work for McDonald's going back to when we acquired that client, which is almost 3 years ago. Now we're doing a lot of commercial work and some corporate work. So it's started. We've got a lot of work to do to explain and communicate and engage with clients. It's what I was talking about there, working with the data and the client service directors and partners to make sure now we do a proper client review. We're about to embark on a client review of our top 100 clients by revenue and making sure that over the next couple of months we do a proper review. And from there, we anticipate that some of that capability that we now have will shine through, and then we'll start to see, hopefully, more work coming from the corporate clients. So it started, but there's a lot of energy that we're going to put into this to really try and grow organically through what is now obviously a much more substantial client base than it was a year or two ago.
Brilliant. Thank you.
And we'll go to Sam Dindle from Stifel.
Morning, guys. Three questions from me, please. Firstly, on how you sort of describe organic growth, is it fair to assume the base for this year is now 101? And then that should be perhaps 10% plus, given the comparator is weak in the first half from COVID, and you know, you've got a good exit rate there. Secondly, on lateral hires, you hired 29 partners last year. Are you able to give an indication of how many partners you potentially interviewed to get that, to that 29? And how quickly could that number accelerate going forward, given COVID is impacting more traditional law firm models? And then finally, on the dividend, you're sort of suggesting you'll pay it next year. Why do you think you need to pay a dividend, given is it better to put the headroom into M&A to drive shareholder value? Thanks.
So yes, Sam, you're exactly right there. In terms of the base for organic for next year, we will take the 103 million, take off the 2.1 million from the acquisitions during the year, which will give us the base for organic growth next year. We would always guide towards double digits. Sort of growth is where we want to go. We feel that's a good base for us. So that's what we think we will do. And obviously there was some soft figures in the first half of the year, which we would hope we can beat sort of going into next year.
On the lateral hires, we've now got a recruitment director that does a lot of filtering for us. So the client service directors and myself and about another half a dozen partners. So there's about 15 of us doing the interviewing of the lateral hires. But it's all managed and run through a recruitment director who's actually expanded his team recently. I'm guessing as to the filtering process, because that's more for Tim to do. When we see people, when we've got a very high conversion rate as to we want to hire and they want to come because Tim's done his work. So the 15 of us involved with recruitment, it would be right up in the 80-90% of people. We generally know that we want to hire the person before we've met them because of the work that's being done. As far as growing that, it's been a really interesting recruitment period these last 12 months. We saw a lot of activity as we kind of were in June. I think there was a bit of panic amongst the profession, and I think we saw a spike there in recruiting partners. We then saw that over the winter just tail off a bit, and it's come back, but it's not quite come back as we think it will when we're all back in offices. I think there is now a sort of feeling of I'll see what happens in my existing place before I decide to what to do with my career sort of going on. I think our presence and our scale and reputation, I think, is going to mean that we will see an increase in recruitment activity as we hopefully come out of lockdown into our offices. We are, though, more focused now on the quality of the candidate than probably ever before. And we're probably now more choosy than we've ever been before. We can hire bigger hitters than we've ever done before. So I don't necessarily see the volume going up. I think the quality is going up. We've got one partner joining us that will bring circa £1 million, probably a bit more of following. But we have a plan to grow that business to £4 million with that partner. That's one partner who's joining, and that's a three-year plan. These are different partners than we've hired before. So there's a lot of work goes into making sure that we see the right people. And as ever, the thing is cultural fit that drives us. We're passionate about making sure that we're recruiting the right behaviour so that we have a very high retention rate, which we do for new hires. The dividend point you've made, I think, is that you're never going to please everyone with dividends. I think some of our shareholders will say, why are we bothering with dividends? This is a growth story we don't need to see a dividend. Other people like the discipline of a dividend being paid and just having that health and ability that we can service the dividend in that way. So I think it has mixed reviews. I don't think we'll please every all the time. The way we navigate through those two opinions is to pay a modest dividend of 20% of profits after tax, which is what we're going to resume for this period now, starting on May. That will please some and it won't please others, but that's the decision we've reached for just to show a sort of a good, healthy business that we can pay that dividend.
Thank you very much. And we'll go to Steve Wolfe at Numis. Steve, go ahead and ask your question.
Morning to you both. Just some comments from me on, I think back end of last year, you put up prices. There was a comment on that. So just wondering whether you've hit any resistance or has that stuck? And then secondly, with M&A discussions, you just sort of mentioned there in terms of the lateral hires and the sort of the flow through from last year in terms of how those conversations changed. I was just wondering, can you give any color on the M&A side of those discussions, whether you felt there was some initial panic more incoming, or generally that people want to be part of a better, bigger group rather than panicking to sell their own business?
Okay, do you want to take the first one on pricing and I'll take the M&A question from Steve?
Yeah, so in terms of pricing, Steve, I'm not sure exactly which element, whether you're talking about specific element, but we did put our prices up in November, we've put them up, and we don't generally have any pushback from clients when we're putting up prices. We've not had any drop off in work. We did increase our conveyancing fees, we didn't have any drop off whatsoever in terms of sort of the total amount of work that we were doing. It was actually much higher. There was a very small decline, but much more offset by the increase in pricing that we did. In terms of putting our charge out rates up, the biggest issue that we have, I think we've talked about this before, is convincing our people that they're worth that amount of money. In terms of where we are in the market, we're still very much at market rates, you know, and there's still possibly a little bit further that we could push those rates. But because it's taking the hearts and minds of our people with us to actually charge and record those rates, we sort of do it in a staggered way. But no, we've not had any negative impact, and we never have done as we've put rates up previously.
The other thing I'd add to that, Steve, as well, when we analyse what the other top 50 law firms, and we do that by top 25 and then 25 to 50 and then 50 to 100, when we look at what they're charging, there's still some water between us and them, so there's still a bit of room for us to go with pricing, and we're still tremendous value when we compare ourselves to peers on headline rate and achieve rate. We look at both of those levels. So it's not the clients that the issue there. We're taking our people on a journey with that, as Kate's mentioned. On the M&A side, I've said this before, and I think the last two Mondays and Keebles sort of illustrated this. I didn't think pricing was going to come down through a panic from law firms to sell, because as well, we're not looking to buy distressed businesses. We want to buy really good quality businesses. And pay a sensible value for them, and then integrate them and have good people, good clients. That's what we're acquiring. So I never thought pricing was going to come down substantially, but I was pretty sure it wouldn't be going up either, and it might just sort of tickle towards mid-range, if you like. And I think we saw that, certainly with Keebles. I thought we got that for a sensible price, sensible for them, sensible for us. And we got a really good business there for the right type of valuation for both parties. So I don't think it's changed that much on valuation. And as far as my appetite for sellers, it's always a tricky one, because you can't go into this sector, which is quite unique in how it's all structured with partnerships, apart from the likes of us. And you can't go and talk to the owners. You talk to a committee of partners who are profit sharing and actually competing with each other. So they have a very sort of have a range of agendas and motivations that you have to sort of almost facilitate through and navigate through. I think we've become accomplished at helping that seller group come together, but it means that you get different reactions with different law firms. I think if anything, as we come out of this, the fear factor will have been quite recent that this was a challenging, and this is certainly borne out in conversations I'm having now. And people have got, I think, a bit more appetite to consider what next, because they've just had this as a stark reminder of how difficult things can be. I think a bigger factor, though, is the lack of succession now in the model. What I mean by this is that the next generation of the 30-somethings coming through have a much diminished appetite for equity partnership to go and borrow $250,000 from the bank and put it into as a partnership loan without really understanding what's going on. That appetite has diminished substantially over the last decade. So the partners, to even get their capital account out on retirement, is a succession issue for them. And if we come along, that is solved, and it's even better than that. They then get something for goodwill. So it's really music to partners' ears if they can be together enough to receive the approach or the discussion. So I think it will improve slightly. I don't think it'll be dramatic. I think that lack of succession is a driver that will see acquisitions continue very healthily over the next few years.
Some of the law firms who you might have competed with on a local level, have you sort of seen evidence of them sort of no longer operating?
I don't think there's been as much of that as I think there has been law firm failure. I think it's when I've read about it, it's tended to be the very small sort of high street firms. I think there's been a few hundred high street firms out of the 11,000 vanish The last number I saw was 500. But in our sort of market of independents ranging from, say, 5 million to 50 million, of which there's sort of circa 100 of those, I don't think there's been many failures. I think Laura has proven itself to be pretty resilient through this. I think it struggled with technology. I spoke to a firm yesterday that's quite small, turning over 4 million, and they actually never went into remote working. They actually stayed in offices all the way through from the off from last March because they didn't have the technology to work from home. And I think there's been a lot of that going on with smaller firms. But I think, generally speaking, Laura's proven itself, as you've seen with other firms and peers reporting, I think there's been a resilience from the lead profession through this that you perhaps wouldn't have thought about. And certainly last March, April, May, it felt very choppy, but it quickly started to level off. And I think has shown itself to be a resilient sector. So no, I don't think that certainly in that sort of middle space of the independence that we're consolidating, I don't think there's been many failures.
And we'll go to Joe Spooner at HSBC. Joe, go ahead.
Hi there. Just a follow-up on the question on prices. At the other end of the equation, have you seen any kind of pressures on costs? Is wage inflation now creeping in into that cost base? Thanks.
I think we needed to do a good, solid salary review this time because we'd missed one a year ago. So when we went into COVID and lockdown, we skipped April 20 salary review, obviously. So when we were coming to salary review this time just gone from 1 May is when the new salaries kick in. It was 2 years ago for the people that were there 2 years ago. And there was the new people as well that having their first review through what's been a tricky year. So we put a lot of energy into the salary review this time. I think we perhaps felt then a little bit of salary pressure, but not much. I think it was much more about making sure that we did a good job of rewarding people for all the effort they put in over over the recent times and over that previous 2 years from when they previously had a review. I think probably now, I think there is probably some salary pressure creeping in and developing because I think there will be a bit of a war for talent now because I think things are going to be very buoyant. And I think people in certain disciplines, like corporate perhaps and other areas, I think are going to be able to command higher salaries. I think there will be some pressure. I think in our regional world, it's always dampened. It's always much more reduced from what you hear about in London with the magic circle firms and the American firms that are paying really high salaries to NQs. That puts a lot of pressure on the magic circle, silver circle. That doesn't then migrate into the regional world. It's they're worlds apart. I mean, an American law firm now will pay $150,000 plus for an NQ. We're paying 40, 35 to 40. They don't touch those worlds. So I think there could be some salary pressure, but I think in our world it will be modest. I don't think it's going to cause us too much sort of pain or headaches.
When we think about the prices that you did put through, should we think of those as being margin enhancing or kind of margin neutral?
I think we'd always want to say margin neutral because we've got to do some work. Whenever we do an increase in a rate, in a rate card, it takes time to come into the business because 75% of our work is on a fixed price basis, not hourly rate basis. So we then have to work with all the partners, and we're doing this currently, to start to reflect the rate card that we changed on the 1st May into those fixed pricing. So that's a lag there, and it's quite a significant lag. There's also a lag with the framework clients. We've got quite a few client arrangements that get reviewed annually or even every 2 years. So that has to then be built, and it takes time. It's also absorbed, salary increases have gone into that rate change. The rate change is there to keep up with some of our increased costs. So I think we'd always want to guide sort of to stay where we are because I think that would be prudent. Obviously, we're always striving for margin gain. We look at the gross margins, Kate's saying, and the PBT margin. That's how we run the business. We don't run it on fees. We run it on striving for the best gross margin we can, and then that translates into the PBT margin. And we've got a very strict control over our fixed overheads outside of salaries. So yes, we want to improve the margins, but there's also a lot of things at play before you can actually deliver those results.
I think the other thing to just pick up there, Joe, is as we continue to invest organically, as we're sort of recruiting people, that is also, so although part of, you know, we, as we're putting up prices and we're sort of looking at building our margins slightly, slowly, as David said, it's a gradual movement, but we're also looking to invest in organic growth of partners. And as I said, as we bring those in, the first year of a new partner coming in, for example, will actually be have a negative impact on the margin because it will take 3 to 6 months, maybe 9 months sometimes, before they're hitting the margins that we want them to be. So as a growing business, we always need to balance that into it when we're looking at what an impact on changes in prices will have on our overall margin.
And we'll go to Tom Callan at Investec. Tom, go ahead.
Hi, Jack. Just three from me quickly, if I may. Just on, there's a state there, a sentence in the statement that talks to new quality instructions and increased quantum of those. Can you just sort of explain what you mean by that precisely? Does that sort of infer like higher billings per Vienna or, you know, increased pricing? I'm just trying to get a handle as to what you actually mean by that. And then just on the partner joins in the year, obviously, as I think someone mentioned it before, in terms of the 29, if you recruited 18 in H1 and you guided to 12 joining the business in H2, that gives me 30. So I'm just trying to understand how you've ended up with 29 and what the pipeline looks like moving into 22. And then on the sort of talent pool point, a wider point in terms of, you know, London law firms potentially, given sort of hybrid working models, looking to recruit from perhaps outside the M25. What does that do to your ability to recruit graduates and newly qualified if some of the better paying firms inside London are also looking at that talent? Thanks.
Okay, I'll pick up on those, Kate, if I may. So when we talk about quality, I think we're talking about scale as well. I think when you think the likes of McDonald's and the other clients we put in the presentation, they're not just trophy clients. They have scale of work, they have volume of work that means we can apply more resource to it to then know the consistency, the consistent levels of work. Once a client gets above 500,000 of fees, you can start to plan resource around that client. And we have, you know, some clients who are paying us $1 million+. It allows us to plan. That for us would be part of the quality. The other part of the quality is size of transactions. We're certainly seeing we have a different now ability in things like M&A and tax and those sorts of things, which means that we're attracting larger transactions, which would have larger fees to it. I think overall the fee mix, because we do so much and we're so diverse and we do such a volume of work, that I don't think it particularly tracks through into a significant change in fees per Vienna, et cetera. The partners, the 29 is the number of partners that started in this financial year period that we're reporting, and we thought 30 and it was 29, so we were sort of pretty close to what we anticipated. We have seen, we saw a real spike in last summer as we were in the first half. Despite what was going on trading-wise, we saw a great activity in recruitment that we talked about with those 18. That's definitely slowed off in this second half. I think people are now waiting to see what return looks like for them before they jump. We're still seeing good recruitment, but it's definitely reduced from that spike of last summer. I anticipate, as I've said already, that might come back. I think when things settle down into living with COVID, so this could be next autumn or even sort of going forward to next year, calendar year, then I think we will, as our presence has grown, I think we'll still maintain a good level of recruitment, but it does go up and down. And at the moment, I think it's hopefully going to start to go up at some stage. The London law firm point you made is an interesting one, because I think we see the opposite way around. I think now people, and we've certainly, the commercial partner I mentioned that's been handed virtually the McDonald's account, actually called us out of the blue. He was in a London firm, and this was April, May, so quite quickly in lockdown, and then he started in January. He didn't want to be in London, he wanted to get out. And I think we're seeing this from some people, that they think, why am I commuting into London now? I want to stay nearer to where I am. I want to work more at home, but be in an office that's closer to my home. I think our regional model, actually, we see as sort of being stronger post-COVID, with people challenging the that sort of question of commute. I think with younger people, certainly if you go right to sort of people that have done the legal practice course and want a training contract, they want the training contract, and there's always a big group of people to hire in the graduates, and because they're looking, there's more graduates than there'll ever be training contracts. So you there, we're focused on raising the quality of our paralegal group from where we give the training contracts out. So there's certainly never going to be a shortage of paralegals or trainees. And then from there, you bring your youth academy into play to get to your solicitors. We really focus on trying to develop our own solicitors as much more than we do recruitment. Recruitment is more focused on associates who've sort of reached 5 years plus PQE. We want to grow our own solicitor group through a youth academy, because culturally that's a very strong thing to do for us. And we've got people in the business that started 9 years ago who are now 6-7 years PQE because they were a paralegal 9 years ago. And because we've got a very unique culture, once they've sort of been part of it, it's quite challenging for some of those people to think about going into a traditional, more old-fashioned style of partnership. They don't want to make that move. So we don't see any issues for ourselves through COVID. It'll be the opposite way around. We think there's going to be recruitment opportunities that come from this.
David, do you have any closing remarks?
No, just thank you all for your attendance and thank you for your questions. I always think the Q&A brings this to life. It's been a pleasure to present to you all. We remain very excited. I think hopefully now, as we can get back into offices, as I said already, I think the energy levels are going to really sort of increase in the world, hopefully as a whole, but certainly in our business, we can feel it. And we can't wait to get back out and all together again. It's going to be an exciting, hopefully, summer, autumn, as we then come and present to you next time. So until then, bye for now, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
PI World videos and podcasts are for general information and interest. They do not constitute any kind of recommendation or inducement to buy shares of any company. PI World is not offering any kind of financial advice, and nothing in our material should be taken as such.